Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen the Warman. Normally, I'd open the show with you are listening to this podcast in one of two ways, but we're going to be in a whole lot more ways now that I've been joined on with the Between Rounds Radio. Shout out to my friend TJ DeSantis for that opportunity. The Warman Kickfighting Show will be on Spotify, will be on iTunes, of course, will be on SoundCloud. We're going to be on a lot more media platforms, so going to have to work on that new intro. But I want to thank Between Rounds for having me, and I really want to kick this first show off on the network with something that I think every kickboxing fan should know. I have a list of 30 of the number one things that any kickboxing fan should revisit. I'm going to break that down slow, and we'll go through it week by week. But first, I want to go ahead and talk about a couple of events that are coming our way. Oh, just one event in particular. A new tournament. It's got a show going down this weekend on the 10th. It's got some good fights on it throughout. I won't talk about all of them, but I do want to talk about a few. Victor Pinto gets a fight with Adam Noy. The reason why this surprises me a little bit, not that Victor Pinto is fighting for them. He's wanted to fight in one for a while. He likes being in the area. It's very important to him. The reason why this is a intriguing bout to me is that it's in kickboxing. You know, he's got a full rules Muay Thai style. So I was very surprised that when he, you know, chose to have his debut for them that he would do it in kickboxing. Now, for all I know, they asked him to do that. But, you know, I thought that for sure he'd come out and want to do full rules Muay Thai to the skill set that he's used to. Again, Victor Pinto is probably one of the bigger names. He was in Glory Kickboxing for a little bit, had mixed results there, was stopped with a spinning back kick, I believe, in his last bout. But he's still a very, very talented guy. And, you know, the girls love him in Thailand. Like, you know, he's in a very popular relationship with Zaza Sohari. Their Instagram followers are like through the roof for people who are like that sort of thing. But the biggest thing I'm trying to bring up is he is a known commodity. Like, people know who he is. So one just announcing today that they're going to do 50 shows this year, and they partnered with the Thai government to do some of the shows, especially the Muay Thai based. Their MMA comes and goes for one. It's kind of hard to follow, and not everybody kind of knows who's at the top. You know, they just kind of like the fights if they like it. But they actually, for full rules Muay Thai, you know, they've been using some of the bigger Thais that they have, you know, Muang Tang and Ra Tang, who I'm going to talk about a little bit. But they've got some of the elite talent. They just have to organize it in a way that people can follow. When they don't do that, it's just kind of like, what's the fight event this week? So with that announcement, it does mean that Victor has the opportunity to fight full rules Muay Thai, but for whatever reason, he chose not to go in that direction. So definitely curious what the thinking is there. Some of the other bouts that they have on the card as far as Muay Thai goes, Han Zihoi, who will take on a Madhi Zitaut. Zitaut's fought for them many times before. Okay talent for both of those guys. Nothing jump out of the gym. Here was a name that the whole entire kickboxing community knows. Liam Harrison takes on Muhammad Bin Momad. Here's the thing with Liam. You know, so far he's been going against really tough ties since he's had his opportunity to fight and won. And he hasn't been able to be his old self. He has success in moments, but man, you know, he has been unfortunately stopped, or the calls haven't gone his way, you know, decision-wise. And again, it's because he's going against super tough opposition. I think the whole of kickboxing and Muay Thai is better when Liam Harrison is winning. It's just one of those names that's like, okay, when you think about England Muay Thai, who you think of, he's name number one, you know. And even though he's had some recent loss, he's still probably the most popular international Muay Thai fighter from England. Not necessarily the best because he's not in his prime, but he's still very good. You know, even he would probably say, I was at my peak when I fought, you know, Anwar the second time or something like that. Like he just, he's not where he used to be, but he is still a super talent. He's still a very popular name. Muhammad is still a game opponent who's going to give him a good look. So I'm curious to see how that breaks down. Sangmini is going to go against Kenta Yamada. Sangmini, super talented. They've used him on, you know, several cards. But again, the excitement behind it is just that he used to be a, you know, Thai regular in the major stadiums. They don't have the excitement of this is the guy to pay attention to because he just beat this guy. Just got to have a little bit more story, a little bit more. The term we use in kickboxing is roadmaps. The reason why there's such a tournament history in kickboxing and full rules Muay Thai, I'd say more in kickboxing. The reason why that history is there, it's because it lets you know where we're headed. So you look at the K-1 World Grand Prix. First, you had to win a regional tournament. Then the regional tournament got you an opportunity to fight in, you know, one of the eight spots for your continent, you know, the European Grand Prix, you know, something like that. Then if you win that, you get to go to the elimination round. Then if you win the elimination round, you're in the final eight in the Tokyo Dome at the end of the year. The reason why people look so highly on that era of kickboxing is because of those steps. I can map where this is going. This leads to this, this leads to this, and it tells you who's going to be the champion at the end of the year. So having guys who've got names in stadiums or, you know, Victor Pento, who, of course, fought Glory, and, you know, it's just that's good. But, man, we got to have a map. We got to know how to follow your brand. The main event on this card is just going to be lights out again. Rod Tang, Jit Mengnan will take on Jonathan Haggerty. Jonathan Haggerty is arguably the best fighter in England right now. He, of course, won the title and then lost it to Rod Tang. And now they are doing it, I believe, for the third time. I know it's for sure the second time, but I thought it was the third. Anyways, Jonathan Haggerty, super talented guy. He's really, you know, got the strength to endure the offense that Rod Tang brings at him. He can catch and sweep. He's got the single kick game when he needs it. He knows how to play the game. He knows how to miss and counter. Rod Tang is the kind of Thai that you want to have in your fight product. And I mentioned this before. When I was really big into, you know, kickboxing, right, you know, and Muay Thai, right when I got into it, there used to be a fighter named Sayak. And they would bring Sayak around all over because they had really good management. But he just wasn't the style to watch. Like, he didn't use any kind of aggression. He always played for points. He never really stopped people. And to quote my friend Vinny Shoreman, if you're good enough to clown the guy and not get hit, you should be good enough to get him out of there. And I think that Sayak was one of those guys who never put his foot on the pedal and tried to get a stoppage. Not so with Rod Tang. Rod Tang is trying to kill you from the opening bell. Like, he is aggressive. He brings the fight to you. He is all action, fun to watch, the Thai that you want to have. He is in the mold of a Porn Tanai. Just a guy who's going to be all action in your face. One of us has got to die. Like, that's just kind of his fight style. So as a Thai, he's always a fan favorite. So definitely wanted to, if you guys get the opportunity to catch those fights, that is on the 10th at the Impact Arena in Bangkok. So now that I've got that done, I'm going to jump into the theme that I was talking about. And I'm going to break this up because there really is a lot to it. I'll probably just go with, I don't know, I think 30 is too big. I'll go ahead and make it about 25, 26. Things that you need to do if you're going to be a kickboxing fan. These are must. I will go with, cut the show in half. We'll go from 26 to 17 on my list. And then next time you guys hear me, we'll go from 16 to 1. And then also along with this, I have the 10... things I would have liked to have seen over my period of time of loving and falling in love with kickboxing. So for those who are curious, that period of time where I really fell in love with the sport was around 2000. So for the last 19 years, we're going to 2020. I really want to focus on the events that happened over that period of time. There are multiple reasons why I do this. I'd say the biggest reason of the of them all is because if I want you who have never heard this podcast before, if I want you guys to hear this and be like, okay, how do I get into kickboxing if I was never in kickboxing before? I would rather give you some content that you could get a hold of and see readily as opposed to something that happened in the 80s that would be a little bit harder for you to get at. I want you guys to love the sport how I love the sport. So, if somebody were to ask me, you know, a lot of people know that I coach a lot of high-level MMA fighters. If someone were to ask me what MMA fight should they watch, I wouldn't go to, you know, a Griffin Bonner. You know what I'm saying? It was good in its day. But I wouldn't use that as an example because there's so much more readily available content that they should watch instead. I would immediately go to Gaslam Adesanya because it just happened. So in that way, when I break down this list of your third, you know, your 26 as I have it here, must to do in the kickboxing world, mostly kickboxing for this list, The reason why I'm starting with a lot of these names is because I really want you guys to sit down, put these names into Google, and fall in love with them the way I fall in love with them. So we'll go ahead and get started. First of all, number 25, I got to start off with Andy Hoog. The importance of Andy Hoog, the story of him, of course, goes he is a Kyokushin karate guy. So for those who don't know, Kyokushin is the hardest form of karate. So sometimes you'll hear, you'll see someone at a gym. Shout out to, you know, like Wonder Boy, for example, in MMA, he's kind of giving people a different idea of how karate can work in like an MMA setting. But like Kyokushin, as far as what is asked of you in fighting, the term we use is hard. Kyokushin is the hardest form of karate. So the people who perform Kyokushin are usually some of the hardest people on the planet because they are so used to observing offense and continuing. It's something else. And it's soft tissue offense. You know what I'm saying? Like they're observing low kicks. They're taking body kicks. They punch to the body. They can only kick to the head. They can't punch to the head. But the goal to that is to strengthen and harden the body. And when this came out, when K1 came around, Andy Hu was one of the better Kyokushin guys in Japan. And he came to the tournament and then he got stopped right away. The thing was, I guess he didn't understand how a mouthpiece was supposed to work. So he never had it settle right in his mouth. So when he went out there, he was getting dropped by shots that shouldn't have dropped him because he didn't know he was supposed to be biting down on the mouthpiece. Like he just didn't know it because in his former karate, they didn't do that. Like he didn't compete with one. So after he got the mouthpiece thing figured out and, you know, after, you know, we lost him as he died of leukemia, I remember Peter Arts saying, you know, he wasn't that good in the beginning and then he just got better. Andy Hoog was one of the first Kyokushin guy to win. I don't know what you would call Brocco Sikatic, but he was the first Kyokushin guy to really get a K-1 World Grand Prix Championship in an era that had some really good ones. Francisco Filho was a really good one, came a little bit later. So he came out there, undersized heavyweight, very, very important. So I would say those guys are like monsters walking around out there. Hoog's in there like 5'10 and probably weighs 210 pounds. And he's able to mess with these guys who are like 5 inches taller than him and probably outweigh him by 40 to 50 pounds. And he just knew how to get in position. He knew how to generate his hips and his shoulders to get position and power. He was just a phenomenal, phenomenal fighter. He was such a name that K1 was able to go, his home country and do shows. And he had a personality, he had a charisma about him. There was something about this guy that drew people to him. And he's one of the first big stars. And his death was such an important part of kickboxing because it really did, you know, bring people together and help them to understand that this really is a sport of martial artists. Because anybody, there are guys that he bought by, you know, won by KO, and they all showed up to be there at his funeral. So Andy Hoog, definitely one of the things that you need to put in and Google and find out more about this guy, Andy Y-H-U-G, Andy Hoog. His most memorable, most popular fight would be when he won the K-1 World Grand Prix. He wins it with a spinning hook kick to the leg that lands perfect against Bernardo, and then Bernardo's done. Now, again, if you hear like a Joe Rogan break it down and stuff like that, there's a lot of excitement for this technique. But in truth, it was a tournament, and Bernardo had sustained heavy low kicks in the first two fights to get himself to that final. So really, he just took advantage of, wounds that were already there before he got in the fight. But no one cares about that. It really was an awesome display of technique to stop someone. It's like if you were to make your highlight of yourself, how would you want it to be? You know, we usually dream of, you know, ending the World Series with a home run or winning the World Cup on a PK or, you know, scoring the final touchdown of the game on the last play. Like, that's how we imagine ourselves in other sports. Andy Hoog has this crazy spinning hook kick. That's just, you know, insanity that someone could land that. And shout out to him and the success that he had with it. We move on from the great Andy Hoog and from that great highlight to talk about the fight that just happened recently. Even though it probably wasn't aesthetically the best fight, it was probably the most important fight in Muay Thai in the last 10 years in international Muay Thai. Liam Harrison takes on Fabio Pinca. So if you were to tell me who is the most important Muay Thai fighters in the last 15, 20 years, you know, outside of Thailand. You know, your forerunners, the guys who are doing it international. The two names that would come up to me right away would be the best Frenchman and the best Englishman. And the reason why I say that is because France has got such great promoters and they do such a good job of putting on regular Muay Thai shows. They have such good coaches in such a small area. Shout out to Nasser Kay and his guys in Lyon. Fabio Pinga was one of them. You know, Fabio Pinga's got a win over Sanchai, a debatable win over Sanchai. He won the first Thai fight. Thai fight, the way it is now, it is a spectacle where elite Thais beat up unprepared Westerners. But when it started, it was a legit tournament that was put together extremely well, and Pinka won that tournament. Then after, you know, and it was a year, it was like 32-man tournament, and at the very end, he won the tournament. And then the following years, Bukau had won one, and it was actually pretty competitive for a little bit there. But then they brought that team on tour, and Pinka would always win whenever they would go on tour, and then the rest of the guys were Thai. And then one day, they just decided that people would rather see the Thais just kill these guys, so Fabio Pinka wasn't used as much. So Fabio Pinka has a great resume in full rules Muay Thai, and he'll dabble in kickboxing here and there as he fought for his Showtime and so on. Liam Harrison, exact same trajectory. He was a guy who fought and won internationally on several stages. Like he was clearly the best guy at like 18, 19, 20 years old. Liam Harrison, I first heard of him. There was a magazine that we had that was an English-based magazine, and he was on the cover of it. And somehow I got over to America. So then I read about him, and that's when I first found out about him and his coach Richard Smith and Lisa Houghton Smith. And Liam was the guy early, had all the skill, young guy, future in front of him, wanted to battle and banging out with everybody. Super, super, super talent. Had a great career, fought really good ties. He had a fight where he went, and I was there in Jamaica, where he fought Anawat, and Anawat stopped him with low kicks, ended up injuring his shin. When he recovered, he did that fight again, and he won the rematch in England. And, you know, Anawat, of course, is, you know, one of the more popular Thais because he really did bring a KO style. We'll talk about him a little bit later. But, like, between fighting Sanchai, between fighting his time, he had a couple fights in Glory. He had kickboxing and Muay Thai fights all over the world. Liam was the guy. You know, he didn't finally lose until, you know, last year and a half to another guy from England, but he was the guy. And these two put on a very solid fight. I would say that the boxing was the difference when they finally met, but these and Fabio Pinka was able to get the decision in that. But there's nothing more important than understanding that, dude, this guy, these two guys of their era are one and two. And they really are the best forerangs resume-wise of the last 15 years for sure. So I'm excited to see them, and that's why they have to be in this list. Liam Harrison, LiamHarrison, and then Fabio Pinka, FabioPinca. Check them out. Find them on Instagram. They got highlights. They've got fights and kickboxing. They've got mostly successful big-time wins, and they've got a few KO losses. If you fight enough, you'll have them both happen. But shout-out to both of those guys. Next, I want to talk about the Heroya effect. So Heroya is one of the most important people in the history of Japanese kickboxing, and not even in the way that you would think. So Heroya was this young kid who had showed early signs of being a talented kickboxer when he got older. Got into the sport really, you know, really early. Had a look about him that I think that they probably misdiagnosed. They probably thought he was more physically attractive than he was as far as his appeal to women. But he showed this talent early on. So then they started to use blocks on the K1 World Grand Prix, or K1 Max World Grand Prix. The fighting events, not including the Grand Prix, excuse me, more so the elimination, more so their single fight, single night events. They started to give him slots on there. And one of the slots, he did an exhibition with Masato, because that was it. Masato's like, this is going to be the kid. And they did an exhibition, and it's just, You know, not like the exhibition we saw a couple weeks ago with Takuru and Ogawa as they were trying to kill each other. This one was a legitimate Masato, grown man, one of the best fighters in the world. Hiroya, 13 years old. You know what I'm saying? So what happened was when they had this kid, they tried to put together a tournament. And the basis of the tournament was to prove that this was the kid to follow in Hiroya. This is of no fault to Hiroya. I should be mentioned. He has been fighting and training and putting himself into a good position. But they really thought this was a good idea. So then they came up with the idea for something called Koshin. And Koshin was their brand of youth kickboxing that was going to create the stars of tomorrow. The goal to it was that Hiroya would be one of the stars of tomorrow. The accomplishment of it was it created the stars of tomorrow. Hiroya just wasn't the one of the best ones. So Saki Nori, he had won one of the tournaments. He showed this really good kickboxing style right away. Had a whole bunch of fights. Of course, you guys know I call the young man my son because I've only been following him since the very, very beginning. When they did the Koshin tournaments, they had headgear and shin guards on. And sometimes they had their karate gis on. And I watched so much of it and I was like, okay, this is the guy. And then Nori ended up winning one of the tournaments. Hiroya won the second tournament, and the second tournament he'd won against Koyarabe. Koyarabe went on to be K1 max champion, like at the one of the lower weights. I believe he won it at 60. I want to say he won it at 60, and then I want to say he won another one at like 62.5. But those are Koya birthed from there, Masaki Nori birthed from there. All their young stars that they have now, with the exception of a few, were all birthed from this. The problem, not necessarily the problem, but the only thing was in accomplishing it, they did miss on Hiroya. He wasn't the guy to spearhead it. He still had a great career. He still has a lot of wins. He started up a gym at 20 years old. I think it was like the Tryhard Gym or something like that. He really got going. And Tryhard has produced some really good fighters. He got going into the sport really, really early. He was just unfortunately misdiagnosed as this is the guy. And that's of no fault of his own. Like, there's nothing in me that's like, you did this to yourself. You know what I'm saying? You made this happen. No part of me is like, you asked for this. He clearly was a really good, you know, kickboxer that showed some promise. But elite promise is something to, you can't really guess that. You got to see that through wins. And he wasn't able to get the big wins, but he did have some solid wins, put on some great fights. Fought Masaki Nori, very tough a few years ago. Talented guy. I wish him all the best. And I'm glad that he was able to recover his name because it wasn't his fault. Even the crowd started to turn on him. You know, like, what are they doing pushing this kid on us? And then another situation where a friend was there live and the girls were like, this guy's not that cute. Why are they pushing him on in that way? Like, it just was done the wrong way and it wasn't his fault. So later for him to turn things around and put together a really good career, I was really, really excited for him. So we're going to go ahead and move on into the list. Next, I'm going to talk about Owortan Tashira. Okay, so now you hear the name Owortan Tashira. They called him Monster. He was the end of the great Kyokushin kickboxer. Now, I'm not saying that they're not out there and they can't come back again, but Monster was it. He'd won the heavyweight division several times in a row. He was in that line of Francisco Filho and Galabe Fitoza, and as we mentioned before, Andy Hoog. And it's just something about this guy. You know, he had the dreads, he had a look. Like, he was feared in Japan as a Kyokushin fighter. So when he made his way over to kickboxing, people were like, okay, this is the next one. You know, he's the next Brazilian. He's a little bit different. He's Afro-Brazilian, very, very dark skin. Dreads, different kind of look. And as talented as he is, it didn't happen for him either. He has known mostly for bad KO losses. He's got one really bad KO loss to Overeem and a clinch in the knee. And he just it didn't come together for him. And it's important as I run this list off to you that not everything is a success story and the history of what made kickboxing great. But Tashira was the last guy from the Kyokushin heavyweight class that you were told, pay attention to this guy. This is the guy. He's a super talent. You're going to get nothing but the best from this guy. it was really, really important that he go out there and have success. And he had all right success, but it just didn't work out in the end. He wasn't able to capture a K-1 World Grand Prix. He wasn't able to go to a K-1 World Grand Prix final. I don't even think he was able to go to a K-1 World Grand Prix semifinal. Like, it just didn't happen for him. Struggled in the elimination round several times. Again, tried his best. Tough guy, you know, worked hard. Had the boxing just didn't come as clean. He's got a couple of good wins here and there. The low kick game didn't show up as much at the elite level. It just, he was the last, though. It's very important. Now, if I talk about a great kickboxer, even a great kickboxer from Japan, you almost never hear the Kyokushin background. So the very end of the elite future heavyweight Kyokushin fighter, Ueda Teixeira, didn't happen for him. But the monster is very, very important to kickboxing. Next, I am going to talk about some of the women that you must know that really put in some work over the last 20 years. I could go down the long line of this list in particular because some of them are still putting their campaign together, but there are, especially in the last 10 years, a group of women that really, really stand out. These women are Anissa Mexen, Amon Barlow, Tiffany Von Seuss, Denise Kielholz, and Irina Bars. They are very, very important. Now, again, I can go back a little bit further because we've got Jermaine Durandami, because she, of course, went on to MMA success. She killed it as a kickboxer for a long time. And then she was in the unfortunate mold of, in kickboxing, once you're elite, you stop getting opposition, you know? So Jermaine Durandami beat up everybody that was in her weight class. She only came back for one kickboxing bout because a girl in the area was getting stronger and she really wanted to test herself against Jermaine. Jermaine dropped her in the final round, but the girl got up and got to a decision. So definitely want to bring up Jermaine. That's very important. Lucia Riker would have been before my time of falling in love with kickboxing. That was in the 90s. I had to do some searching to find out about Lucia Riker, but she was before it. But I definitely want to say Jermaine. She's very important. Definitely want to say Julie Kitchen. She's very important. Julie Kitchen was the bridge because she kind of came right after Jermaine was done. And she had the look. She had the cool tattoos. She had the clinch style. She good with the kicks and the length. Fought Jermaine very tough, like didn't, you know, get wobbled or hurt. She just lost the decision. As far as physical traction and just the way she talked and her story, you know, she had twins and her parents said, hey, well, if you want to work some of that baby weight off, we'll take care of the kids so you can go to the gym. And that's what started off her fight career. This whole humble, she's just a mom that went and tried it one day and it turns out she became the best in the world. That story really kind of resonated and took her beyond being a successful fighter. She was someone that was used in international cards throughout the world, PFL, champions versus champions. She really, really brought it. So she's definitely very important. Also, and this is an interesting one, because again, it just kind of speaks to the level of kickboxing and I guess the ability, I would say, to follow the path, you know, like the ability to follow, all right, how do we get to the greats to where we are now? And one of the important steps in there was the transition from from Julie Kitchen to Miriam Nakamoto. And Kitchen did a great job of, you know, doing things well. And then she came over to California and she fought Miriam Nakamoto. And then I think most judges had it even after two or close to that. And then Nakamoto won the last round. So then she became one of the recognized best fighters in the world. Nakamoto also won I won't say won it, but there was a reality TV show about Muay Thai. And on that show, she was the most skilled girl. Other girls, Michelle Watterson was on the show. They did it. It was done at Master Tati's gym in Vegas. But you could see on the pads that she was one of the more skilled girls. She had really good boxing. She was able to then take the mantle. So basically, we're talking from Jermaine to Kitchen to Miriam Nakamoto. After Miriam Nakamoto came that gap. Like that's like the gap at that weight class wasn't filled. And then all of a sudden, PFL happens. And then when PFL happens, Premier Muay Thai League, PML, all of a sudden, when it happens, it introduces the world to Valentina Shevchenko. Valentina Shevchenko had been killing the game for a very long time in the IFMAs, and she had been winning worlds every single year at 60 kg. So she's winning around 132 pounds. So she'd been winning it every single year. She had good boxing. She had good clinch, and she could do a lot of spinning and flash techniques because she had Taekwondo in her background. But there was nothing stronger than her clinch. If she got a hold of you, you were in trouble. Like, that's just kind of how the game was. So you definitely want to be conscious of who she is in the sport. And if you go against her, you've got to prepare for her distance, her movement, her ability to avoid punches, and how strong she is in the clinch. Joanna Jacek, for those who pay attention to the MMA world, fought her four times. All four times had the same trouble. The boxing was a problem, and when you got close enough, the clinch was a bigger problem. And she would score a couple of knees and then throw you on the ground for the dump score. She was just so strong for the weight class. So then she won and have a dominant year, dominant years. And then she gave way to a teenager named Iman Barlow. Iman Barlow, I first heard about her in the late 2000s. So I knew about her during the time of Miriam Nakamoto, Julie Kitchen. During that era, I knew who Iman Barlow was. She told me that basically when she was, I found her because I got on Facebook for the first time. And I started looking for how do I connect to some of the friends that I met when I was over in Thailand. And then their gym popped up and Liam Harrison was on there. And Iman happened to be at the same gym that Liam was at. So then I clicked on and we became friends. And then I asked her some questions. And then I said, hey, could I do an interview for you? I was writing for World Muay Thai Magazine at the time. So then she tells me about her record. And all of a sudden she's like, oh, yeah, I've got like 130 fights and so on. And she was, you know, 15, 16 years old. So I actually got to see her recently and they asked her, how does she know, or like the people of glory asked her, how does she know me? She goes, Stephen gave me my first interview when I was 15. So that's how I ran into who she is. And then all of a sudden I could see it coming. I filmed the documentary Shin on Shin, and in the documentary, it shows her. She had been doing the sport, got tired of training, left the sport for a while, put on some weight, was partying, wasn't living the lifestyle athlete wants to live. Then she said she kind of had like a talk on her own. And during that talk, she realized this isn't something that my parents are forcing me into. This is something that I want for myself. So she took the weight off, became the first Infusion champion, had a great fight with Alexis Rufus. I was there that night when she won the title, had a really great run. Then Infusion puts together a TV show, just like they had done for the men, where they have a tournament to showcase who the best fighter is. Who the best fighter of the tournament at the end gets money and so on. In this tournament, Iman Barlow, she had sustained an injury, but she goes out there and she fights and loses to Anissa Mexen. Anissa Mexen had already been building a name for it. People were like, these two are going to meet. They met Anissa Mexen, gets a stoppage victory over her, and then all of a sudden we start to watch Anissa Mexen. As we follow Anissa Mexen in America, Tiffany Von Soest is starting to make waves. Lion Fight begins their organization. They're mostly men, mostly Vegas-based athletes with a couple California athletes thrown in. Then their card was mostly amateurs, a few people from around the country, and then the main event was world class. And then all of a sudden, the opportunity for Tiffany to build her resume started to come about. Really good athlete, played soccer, was able to have good agility and score, offense from different angles and power shots. And she just, the athleticism is one of the biggest things that gives her an advantage in fights. So Tiffany goes out there, puts on a show, does extremely well. And as she's doing it, there's another girl in Holland who's building a resume along the same time. So we got Iman Barlow, we've got Tiffany Von Soest, and we've got Denisa Kilhotz. Denisa, she's in the same, or Denise, she's in the same weight class as Tiffany. So she's out there, doing things, having success, winning fights. She's a little bit bigger weight class at the time than Iman was. So both of them are competing in Infusion. And then Tiffany Von Soest is given permission by Lion Fight to go over and fight Denise. And it should be noted that when they fought, it was a close competitive fight, but Denisa Kilhotz got the better of her, won clean. It's one of the bigger kickboxing wins in history that not a lot of people talk about. To this now, since we've moved on from there, Kill Holtz is now in MMA. Mont Barlow is champion of Infusion still. And Tiffany Von Seuss is now the Glory champion. But all those women that I bring up, Urina Bars, who of course was a bigger weight champion, Urina Bars had the most important win in all of women's kickboxing. In the history of women's Muay Thai, there's no win more important than Urina Bars beating Cyborg Santos. Because it wasn't just that she beat her. She dropped her on the first shot that she landed. She ran her into a teep. Then after that, she scored a head kick. Later in the third round, she scored a knee and dropped her. Now, Cyborg had fought back and got some clinch stuff, but the smooth kickboxing came from Urina Bars. Those women, those stories, and what they mean, they all have their place. Now, it does help and unfortunate, but if women are pretty, they will always make more money in combat sports. And these women are all aesthetically pleasing to look at. Like that helps, you know, like it helps that they are physically attractive. But it shouldn't be stated enough that they are winners, that they are fighters that had a lot of success, and they've gone out there and competed at a very high level and did some really, really good things. So shout out to these women and what they've done in kickboxing. Very, very important, and I'm grateful to bring that to you. Next, I want to talk about the two most popular ties in my era of paying attention to I'd say most popular just for different reasons, but Sanchai and Anahuac in their ways are the most important ties over the last 20 years. Sanchai is on like a 30-40 fight win streak. I think Fabio Pinto might be his last loss, but he's just been killing it. And he'll just train and he'll go out there and he'll beat people up just on his skill. He's now becoming like a meme because like now when he works the corner with another Thai fighter, he's always joking around. So instead of giving them water, he's like spitting on the other corner man. And he's become, in today's social media with Instagram, there are clips of him sparring with people. And he always does his handstand kick. One period of time he did the handstand kick, knocked the guy out cold. I try to tell people how this works, but basically Sanchai will do rounds with people that are good and are competitive, but those don't make the video clip. We're trying to get, it's a meme. We're a short video generation. And so all those short videos of him like landing head kicks and sweeps and all that kind of stuff that he's doing and sparring all over the world at these seminars, those are all the guys that didn't look good, but he still looked great. And that's important. He has transcended being a really good fighter to the point that nobody even asks who he fights. They just know that he did fight and that he did win. It is more important for them to hear about the seminar, take part in it, see the handstand kick, see the jumping inside leg, see the flash that he plays with, his two-touch kick. He's just a phenomenal athlete. He, in his mid-30s, is probably the most popular full-rules Muay Thai fighter right now, and it's really cool and it's really special for me to see someone have that kind of success and that kind of notoriety. The next person I want to talk about is Anahuac. Anahuac is the kind of guy that he got up to the stadiums extremely quick because he can really punch. He is one of the heaviest hitters in the history of Thai full rules Muay Thai. And usually when he fights, if he goes to a decision, he almost always loses by decision. He almost always gets outpointed. But he goes out there and he throws that heat, and he did it against elite guys. And he'll be losing a fight, and then he'll come back and win by KO. Anahuac was the first kind of real Thai myth that I ever got to be a part of because I just got into the sport. So I kept hearing people talk about this guy. And that's literally how it was. Either they picked him to, you know, I'm on the fight forums, Kakutugi, K1 fans, K1 USA, I'm on those forums and everybody's like, well, if he doesn't win by knockout, he is going to get stopped. He's going to lose a decision. And for someone to have that kind of aura where you're that confident in the outcome, it's just phenomenal. It's really, really cool and really fun to watch. And it was crazy to see him. His highlight was really good. He's got a 12-minute highlight out there that had really great music to it. But Anahuac will always be in history for me as the first guy from Thailand that I was like, look out for this dude. Then when he fought in the international scene, he didn't have as much success because he fought in a style that those guys were used to. In Thailand, they played the game. So they were able to, you know, single score, clinch, do things to kind of neutralize his boxing. But when he went over to Europe, those guys usually play boxing first, kick second, because, you know, a lot of gyms have boxing, you know, backgrounds before they moved into Muay Thai and so on. So he didn't have as much success internationally. I'd say the Liam Harrison win in Jamaica, champions versus champion, was his biggest win. But really, this guy, he was special. He had an aura about him. Those two guys are the main full rules Muay Thai guys that I think my era of kickboxing will pay attention to. I'm not saying they're the best. There are people who have much better stadium resumes. Both of these guys happen to have two sports writers fight of the year under their belt. Anuat won back to back. Sanchai won in 99 and then again in like 2012, which is just insanity. But like, those two are the guys for full rules Muay Thai of my era. So I think I will go one more. No, I'm going to leave that. I'm going to do next week. I'm going to do probably 20 through 10, depending upon where I get. But I want to break it up a little bit more. And then also the 10 things I would like to see, I might save that just for a different episode. There's a lot of content there. But I do want to answer this because it was a question on Twitter. And I am going to go into my Mount Rushmore for French Muay Thai. So my Mount Rushmore for French Muay Thai, it's very important. I'll go Muay Thai and kickboxing. How these names came to me are very important. Now, again, some people are going to disagree with this list, but I thought about it, and I am very, very confident in it. And some of the names are not as big to others, but big to me. Number one, Farid Valloum. Now, the reason why I say that is he's the first guy from France that I truly fell in love with. Had a patient style. His victory over Sophie Alawash was one of the main things that got me into kickboxing as far as, you know, or full rules Muay Thai French kickboxing and full rules Muay Thai and kickboxing from France. That fight was the fight that really, you know, Alawash showed the ability, but Farid hurt him. Then Alawash got up, he says, no, I'm fine. And then they went back and then Farid hurt him again. And, you know, good stoppage. Alawash protested it, but it was a changing of the guard. So that one really, really meant a lot to me. Farid went on to have a really good run. Didn't win them all, you know what I'm saying? Didn't beat, you know, Yotsen Klai, or, you know, but he really did have a great run. I was very, very impressed with him, and he was my guy. He was like my favorite guy at the time. The next person on the list is Fabio Pinca. I would put Fabio Pinca's resume pretty much over any of the other French Muay Thai fighters. Now, I know that's insanity because some of the others had won stadium titles. Damien Alamos won a stadium title. So I don't want to, you know, make it seem like it is only about me and no one else. But, you know, for me, for my list, that was very important. Fabio Pinca was my guy. I was a big Fabio Pinca fan. I'm still a big Fabio Pinca fan. He has done everything skill-wise. He is so talented. And resume-wise, he's my number two. So I got Farid Valloum. I've got Fabio Pinca. Then I have Danny Bill. Danny Bill, I feel like you can't even say French Muay Thai if you don't say Danny Bill. I feel like your Mount Rushmore sucks if you don't have Danny Bill on there. If you only get four guys to put on that statue from France, Danny Bill's got to be one of the four. Okay, he transcends the sport. It's not talent. It's not the fact that he's got a win over Remen Deckers. It's not like those all add to it. Danny Bill was someone different. And I remember I wasn't as big on him. And then someone announced that Danny Bill was making his comeback on the K1 Fans USA, or excuse me, K1 Fans forum. And I was like, all right, hold on. I don't really know this guy as much as I should. I know a few of his fights. They were okay. So then I went ahead and just got immersed in it. Then I became a Danny Bill guy because that's kind of how the fight forums were. You know, like you didn't hear about something and you learned, and then they would either upload the videos or someone would give you a name or give you a source. And we just all learned and loved kickboxing together. And, you know, the names that came across in kickboxing and Muay Thai, you stayed with them. That was one of the big ones. Danny Bill, big time signing, big time fighter and big time. When I say signing, big time in terms of his return and signing on to fight again. Had a great career. He's for sure on my list. And the last person on my list, this was the toughest thing because a lot of people, Skabowski was definitely, one that came up. I know that's very, very important to people. Mirage, one that came up. It came down to Dida and Jerome LeBanner. So I decided to mess up that sculpture and half of the face will be Jerome LeBanner and the other half of it would be Dida. And here's my thing. Dida, who I'm going to talk to about a little bit later as far as, Choke D and stuff like that, whatever. First stadium Muay Thai champion from France. Major stadium, I should say. Very good fighter. The elements, of course, of being in a movie. And then Jerome LeBanner, even though you see him more as a kickboxer, he's a transcendent name in the sport. Jerome LeBanner can go to any kickboxing event in the world and you say, there goes Jerome LeBanner. You can't say that with Dida. You can't say that with Sean. So someone has to explain to you who those other guys are. Everybody knows who Jerome LeBanner is. So really wanted to focus on those athletes. Go ahead, critique me. Send in your messages. Tweet me, at Steven the Warman, if you want to go ahead and get any questions. If you have a problem on my list, love to explore it. But that's my Mount Rushmore, Fred Vallum, Fabio Pinca, Jerome LeBanner and Dida splitting one. And then, of course, the big thing that I wanted to focus on, as far as why these guys are important, it's not just winning fights. Okay. That's part of it. It's not the most important part of it. Danny Bill is important because he won, but he transcended the sport. Fred Vallum is important because he's the first guy that introduced me to how high that level of fighting is. Fabio Pica is important because I feel he has the highest resume and he has the most important win against a full rank over the last 20 years. Jerome LeBanner transcends the sport. Dida, champion as far as the stadiums go. Those are the guys. You know what I'm saying? So that's my list. Go ahead, break it down, send me messages. I want to thank everybody for listening to the podcast. God bless. And really continue to listen to it. Critique me. Send me messages. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Instagram. You guys can see what I do as far as training at my combat sports gym and the different fighters that I work with. But the main thing this podcast is about is kickboxing and Muay Thai. Thank you so much. God bless. And everybody have a good one. Peace.